everyone, once again, to Yukon 360, America's oldest and most trusted podcast about each and every aspect of the University of Connecticut. We are excited to be with you once again from the Benton Museum of Art on the store's campus, and thanks as always to Nancy Stula and the staff here for making us feel right at home. My name is Tom Breen. I am your facilitator of sorts, and joining me are my co-hosts Julie Bartuka.
Happy Wednesday.
And Ken Best.
Yes, it is Wednesday.
We have a terrific episode for you this week, and as you should know by now, I'm not just whistling Dixie. It really is good stuff. We are going to hear from UConn professor Robert Thorson about the enduring legacy of Henry David Thoreau's Walden. We are going to talk to UConn sports superfan Tyler Wilkinson about what it's like to be famous on the internet. And we're going to visit Tom's History Corner to see if we can solve a long-standing dog-related mystery. By the way, we've heard your complaints, and we will be changing the name of Tom's History Corner shortly.
That was a couple of weeks ago, I thought.
There's paperwork we have to get through.
Okay.
And some red tape.
I forgot. We are a state agency.
That's right. All right. Well, why don't we get right into it with Husky headlines, talk about what's happening this week. Ken, what's new?
Here at the Benton Museum of Art, one of the best exhibits of the year, Close Third Person, which is the MFA Class of 2018 exhibit, which continues through May 6th. And there's lots of interesting stuff. There's painting, there's drawing, printmaking, photography, ceramics, installation. There's an opening reception on April 18th from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Over at the Contemporary Art Galleries, which is in the Art Building, Fold In and Fall Flat is a multimedia exhibit created here at UConn over the past 2 months by Yanni Rusica, who is the Sackler Artist in Residence. That continues through May 4th. Yanni has exhibited all over the world, literally. And it's a really interesting exhibit. Most important, there's a puppet that they made. Our students from the puppetry program created a puppet of Yanni. And last but certainly not least, the UConn Science Salon is at the Maritime Center in Norwalk on April 12th. The theme, Kelp Confidential, Secrets of Connecticut's Culinary Seaweed Scene. You get to eat seaweed and then listen to the discussion.
I highly recommend UConn Science Salon. If you haven't been to one, we've brought all kinds of different experts into the community for those over the past couple of years. And if you're in the Norwalk area, I highly recommend going to that.
I once went out on a boat with UConn researchers and ate seaweed right from the sea.
Ugh.
That was pretty good.
Did it taste saltier?
It actually tasted really sweet. It was strange.
That is strange.
Julie Bartuka.
Yes.
What's new?
Well, if you like the story on Steve Wiesensale's Baseball and Society course that we did in Episode 2, Wiesensale wrote a piece for The Conversation on how baseball diplomacy has fortified Japan-U.S. relations. You can find that at today.ucon.edu. Also, some science news that just came out. The journal Pediatrics last week published findings that 76% of food products shown in ads promoting sports sponsorships are for junk food. Researcher Jennifer Harris of UConn's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity contributed to the study, which focused on the top 10 sports organizations watched by children 2 to 17 years old, which include the NFL, NHL, and Little League Baseball. Food and beverage brands are the second largest category of sponsors for these organizations, and these findings concern the researchers because this kind of marketing is a factor in poor diet among children, which is a major driver of childhood obesity.
Probably the Husky headline that most people are familiar with is that the University of Connecticut men's basketball team has a new head coach. Dan Hurley recently announced he's coming here from the University of Rhode Island, and he's been to campus. People are very excited about it. And that's just a really good segue.
You're so good at segue.
Into our first segment this week, as it was the tireless Husky lovers of A Dime Back on the internet who actually broke the news of Coach Hurley's arrival here. And we have, via the magic of the internet, an interview with Tyler Wilkinson of A Dime Back, who's going to talk with us about everything that goes into running a UConn fan site. So joining us here on UConn 360 is Tyler Wilkinson of A Dime Back fame, a UConn sports superfan. A Dime Back also broke some big news recently in being the first to report that Dan Hurley was the new head coach of the men's basketball team. Tyler, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Julie and Tyler, you're friends.
We are friends.
We are.
Way back.
Yep. Full disclosure.
Semi-back. Tyler's good friends with my husband.
And when Julie mentioned she was friends with you, we got excited because there's a lot we want to know about running a popular UConn fan site on the World Wide Web. So if you could you tell us how you got into this, how a Dimeback started?
I was working just a desk job and was looking to get into writing more. It was something I was not really utilizing a lot in my career at the time. And I just wanted to get those chops back. I hadn't done it in a long time. You know, most of my day was spent thinking and talking to other people about UConn basketball. So it just felt like an obvious outlet to just exercise that muscle again. And once we started, it really picked up fast. We had something like a 3-year plan where the first year we were just going to dip our feet in the water, you know, get used to running the site, figure out all the web design, all that stuff. The second year, we were going to start trying to sell ads and see how that did. And then the third year, we were going to try to get credentialed and start covering all the games live. And we ended up doing all three, I think, within the first 9 months we launched.
Wow.
So since then, we have nowhere to go but down. And we're going there rapidly, but we're having a lot of fun doing it.
It is a lot of fun to read. And one of the things I like is the banter with the fans of other programs. Is that something you enjoy doing, kind of being a little salty, a little saucy on the World Wide Web?
I enjoy it a lot when UConn is doing well. When UConn is not doing well, I want to just close my laptop and pretend the rest of the world doesn't exist. But yes, fortunately, you know, growing up in Connecticut as a UConn fan, I've enjoyed most of my life with UConn being relatively great compared to the rest of the sporting world. So there's no shortage of bragging opportunities. And, you know, it's some fan bases tolerate it better than others. There's a few that are really good sports and a few that are not. And depending on, you know, what's happening that day, each can be fun. Each can be fun in its own way.
Do you have favorite fans to go back and forth with from other programs?
Well, you know, much like in college basketball, the historic rivalries are the best, even when they're taking place on Twitter. So Syracuse fans are generally fun, especially when UConn and Syracuse meet in New York every year. I always try to go down with some friends, and we always end up intermingling with people we know who are Syracuse alums. And I generally find them fun and funny and self-deprecating and knowledgeable, which is something I appreciate, even though I hope they lose in humiliating fashion every time they take the court. And then sort of the newer rivalries are less fun, mostly because I'm salty that we have new rivals. So every time there's, you know, someone from Tulsa or Houston in our Twitter mentions, that's not usually a fun conversation.
So now you don't have to betray any confidences or anything like that, but congratulations on the big scoop, first of all.
Thank you.
What was it like being on Coach Watch?
Yeah, you know, it just kind of happened. We were poking around a little bit, just doing our faux journalistic due diligence, and nothing was really shaking forward. I'll shout out Jeff Jacobs, who Julie used to work with at The Current, who's now with Hearst, Connecticut. He broke the story, really, on Monday, and then the story sort of unraveled from him. There was some pushback, and the story kind of got walked back. And it wasn't until, I believe, Wednesday night that we ended up breaking it all over again for the first time when it was officially official. But we really had no intention. We weren't even really chasing it. And then we just happened to start hearing some rumors from people we know connected to the program, and had to sort of do the circular dance where you hear one thing on this end and then you have to run to the other end of the circle and see if you can get someone else to confirm it. And by the time we had sort of circled the whole story, having people corroborating each other's impression of it, you know, we knew we had it. And then it's just a matter of pushing the button, which is terrifying.
Your site crashed right after, right?
Yeah, as soon as I hit the button, and it was about 11:05 at night, the site crashed and we got a server error immediately.
Wow.
And I spent the next 45 minutes on the phone with the hosting company screaming at them as they were telling me, someone will email you in the morning. I was like, no, they won't. No, you're going to do this right now.
I did notice, I will name no names, but I did notice that some legacy media outlets were just kind of pretending that you hadn't broken it. Is that something you encounter? Is there like kind of a reluctance to trust new media or to pay attention to new media?
There is. And, you know, I don't even think it's an unfounded skepticism. Certainly there's a whole bunch of people out there who have the same following as us who I don't know that if they broke news, I would inherently believe it. But getting credited after we were proven right would be nice. And I will say, you know, we spent a lot of time with the Connecticut print media guys, guys like Dave Borges at the New Haven Register and Dom Amore at The Current. And they all have been very congratulatory, very supportive, very gracious, which is, you know, exactly what I would expect from them. They're all really good guys. It's just, yeah, some of the bigger guys, bigger companies out there, a little reluctant to give credit to the little guys, but part of the game.
So So what are your kind of initial thoughts as Coach Hurley comes on board about what this means for UConn, UConn fans?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I think UConn fans should be really excited as well. You know, obviously, people are pretty eager to draw the parallels between him and a young Jim Calhoun when he took over UConn in the late 80s. I think that's not, you know, unwarranted, although, you know, they're fundamentally different. The sport has changed a lot. But Dan Hurley is going to be passionate. He's going to be really a disciplinarian, I think, when he comes to his teams. He's already said they're going to run the hardest practices in America. And I think after the last few seasons, the team could use some refocusing. And I think he's going to be the right man to do that. He's turned around a few programs that were in a lot worse shape than UConn is now. He's not coming in to a situation where the cupboard is completely empty. And I'm pretty confident that he's going to start getting good results pretty quickly, maybe even this next season.
I'm very excited to see what the future holds. What's the best way for folks to catch up with you?
Sure. You can read our blog postings, which admittedly are posted at absolutely no regular frequency and completely whenever we feel like it at adimeback.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at adimeback. Same thing at Instagram, Facebook. We're all over the place, mostly with the same type of irreverent humor that we try to bring covering the sport. We try not to take ourselves too seriously, and I hope it shows in all our work.
Well, it's a voice we love to read as UConn alums as well as UConn employees, and we thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us this week.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You guys are doing great as well. If I have one request for UConn marketing, it's just use Jonathan in as much as possible because I can't get enough of that dog.
We try. We do.
You're doing good work with that dog.
He's a very good boy.
He is a good boy.
All right, that was a lot of fun. Our thanks to Tyler and everyone at A Dime Back. Check them out online if you have not already.
And most importantly, we got another guy from Jersey in stores.
That's right. That's right.
Are many, myself included, but I know of St. Anthony's and the Hurleys from growing up in that part of the world.
Basketball royalty in the Garden State.
Yes.
So as this podcast reaches you, spring will hopefully have sprung, although maybe not. But soon, anyway, and perhaps you will think about going out for some crisp, bracing strolls and communing with nature. One of the most influential American voices in shaping how we think of nature is Henry David Thoreau, and UConn's own Robert Thorson has a new book offering insights into Thoreau's most famous work. Ken Best is here with the details. Ken, tell us more.
Last year, I did a story about a new book that Bob Thorson came out with called The Boatman, where he wrote for the second time extensively about Henry David Thoreau. And it was about his work as a riverman, so to speak, studying the rivers and the flow of water up in Massachusetts. That was his second book on Thoreau. And he got to thinking and realized there was not a guide to Walden Pond that had been published. So he said, let's do a guide to Walden Pond. So I sat down with him and we talked about that recently.
My father was a teacher. He walked in the woods just like Henry David. He could live off the land if anyone could.
Geologist just Robert like Thorson reread Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond several years ago to prepare co-teaching an American Studies class titled Walden and the American Landscape in the Honors Program. Thor, as he is known around campus, found himself drawn to Thoreau's prose, and he began quite literally to explore the landscape of Walden Woods. Immersing himself in Thoreau's journals, he saw the scientist who recorded observations of the land and its environment. In 2014, Thor published the first book in his reassessment of Thoreau's legacy, titled Walden Shore. Last year, he completed the reassessment with The Boatman. When he discovered there was no guide to one of America's most iconic places, Thor suggested writing a visitor's guide to Walden Pond, which is visited each year by 500,000 people. Working in collaboration with the Walden Woods Project, the organization founded in 1990 by musician Don Henley, he has just published the first guide to Walden Pond. Thor spoke with UConn 360 about the book he admits has an unusual approach. He discusses what he wrote, why Walden Pond is a special place, the return of Thoreau's journal to his writing desk, and what he learned from writing The Guide to Walden Pond.
What I really want to do is to carry people into the realm of Walden, which is a challenging text, and to do so piece by piece, stop by stop, and event by event. And I also want to say that Walden Pond is far more than simply Henry David Thoreau. He's the apex for a number of people, especially in the American studies. This is a hybrid guide, and it is a little unusual. A travel guide is exactly what you described. It's like, here's where you should go, this is what you'll see, with a snippet of history or a snippet of some local connection. I think we know that. A Frommer's travel guide, for example, a Michelin guide, whatever. And then there's a trail guide, and I think we know what that looks like. It's like, turn right here, go there, don't fall off that cliff, the lake is to your right. That's a trail guide. And they'll tell you what the conditions might be like and get you ready. And we did that in this book, too. And then there's a nature guide, and this is pretty straightforward. It's look out for the hawks and the chickadees and the hemlocks and the oaks and the pines and the fish and the snails and the vernal pools and so forth. That's a really good nature guide. So we're trying to do all three of those things. But then the last piece is a bit subversive. It's really travel literature. It's a little bit like Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods, or you could argue even Don Quixote's Man of La Mancha. You know, it's a story of a journey, but there are a series of anecdotal and differentiated essays within it. And the idea is that if you're interested in trails, maybe you'll dig into that a little bit. And if you're interested in nature, you will. And if you're interested in this, you'll go through all of this. So I'm hoping that the more scholarly elements of the guide come through as travel literature. It's a special place because it is clean, because it's beautiful, and because it's in metropolitan Boston, and because it is a state park that should be a national park, an international park, if you like. I think about a quarter of the visitors are internationals visiting it for the first time, and they skip the beach and they march straight to Thoreau's house site and meditate on their own. It's also a special place because Walden is probably the most widely studied, complex, somewhat obtuse literary nonfiction text in American history. You could argue that, but a lot of scholars believe that it is. And it's one that is amazing because every time I read it, I get something new. It is so densely packed. Of course, much of Walden comes from the journal, but the real life work is the journal, which is over 2 million words. And he wrote it sitting at that little green desk, thousands of pages of hand-quilled manuscript. And then, of course, he dies, and his desk goes one place, and his manuscripts go another, and they're separated. And the Morgan Library owns most of the journal. And the Concord Museum owns his desk. And when they decided on Thoreau's bicentennial celebration to create an exhibit, the idea was, let's bring the journal written on the desk and the desk used to support the journal back in the same place. And they did. And it was powerful to look at. This is the person's life work is writing, not writing books, but writing the journal, writing to himself, for himself. It's quite a document, and to see those two put together is enough to make you shiver. However, I'm not big on material things. I mean, a book is really just paper, and a desk is really just wood and green paint in this case. But to see them together really made a difference for me. What I learned was that Thoreau is an excellent model for how we should behave relative to several things that seem to be lacking in leadership today. One is living simply. I mean, his key phrase in Walden, the book, is simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. He is a candidate for what we call voluntary simplicity, what we call sustainability, what we call a proper sense of nature, what we call a stand-up for human rights, what we call a literary stylist that is truly amazing. So he has all of these really important things. And of course, they're crammed into a human being or emanate from a human being that is not within his faults. And we've been passed down a rather cranky vision of a misanthrope, a misogynistic misanthrope living in the woods because he can't stand society. That's really, really far from the truth. That says more about us than the reality. It says that we want him to be those things because we're feeling that way, when in fact he was fully engaged with society. The place he built his house was at a triple point. He could go to the railroad and walk it to be with his family. In fact, he was on the railroad so often that they mistook him for an employee. I mean, this is not the man who's hiding in the woods. The other direction went up to Emerson's parlor, where he met with his friends and the other transcendentalists and had absolute good times, you know, discussing the latest theories of the day. And then the third link in that three-trail system was down to the water. And that's where he went down to find the satisfaction and the joy of being alive and to celebrate the simplicity of pure water, a roughly spherical or star-shaped lake, and a world that seemed to make sense from that perspective, and a world that included all kinds of plants and animals and critters.
So, and Thor is talking about this new guide to Walden Pond. In fact, people in stores are very lucky. On April 11th, a Wednesday, at 5:30 p.m., he will be at the Yukon Bookstore at Store Center talking about the book. We should also thank my old friends Pete and Maura Kennedy for allowing us to use their song Just Like Henry David. Maura wrote that in tribute to her father, who is a lifetime Thoreau scholar. Her father is Gordon Boudreau, and he's Professor Emeritus of English at Le Moyne College up in Syracuse, New York.
Well, unlike Walden, you won't find Tom's History Corner on any map, but it's still a place we like to visit.
I never thought of it as a place.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a place in our mind.
It is. It's a place in our heart.
Let's close your eyes and go.
Yeah, that's right. Close your eyes and come with us to Tom's History Corner, where this week we have a solution to a mystery that's long bedeviled Husky historians. But first, a question. How many Jonathans have there been?
14.
Have there?
Maybe not.
I think we're going to find out.
We're going to find out. We're talking, of course, about the lovable canine, Jonathan, who was represented at the University of Connecticut since 1934. He was named for Jonathan Trumbull, the Revolutionary War-era governor of Connecticut, and he is a very good boy indeed. Since 1934, you are correct, there have been 14 dogs bearing the mantle of Jonathan, but the university only recognizes 13.
Dun, dun, dun.
We're not Triscophobiacs.
No, not. The impetus for this piece came about, I had heard a story several times, and actually this is a story that's featured on quasi-official websites about Jonathan, that in 1970, the student government, reflecting the turbulent times, had voted to sell him because he represented the establishment and that he was only saved by a student petition. I'm always looking for a reason to make fun of hippies, so I thought this would be perfect, but I have some news. I'm not sure this ever happened. I looked through every issue of the Daily Campus published in 1970.
How long did that take you?
It took me a while.
Valuable use of our time.
It took our crack research battalion.
This is a research university. We have to do research.
You're right.
And I found no tale of student radicals trying to sell the dog. It could have happened and just not have been covered by the paper, but the papers covered student government pretty extensively. They impeached the student president during that time. So, I mean, there was a lot going on.
And it was around the time of Bill X. Carlson.
It was. Bill X. Carlson came after the impeachment. I mean, we know why people were so upset with student government, I guess. Well, I didn't find any evidence of the plot to sell Jonathan. I did find something else. A secret Jonathan.
There were no secret societies. Oh, yes, there were.
There were.
I forgot. Mark Roy wrote about that once for the magazine when I was the editor.
Journey with us back to 1964, April 1964. UConn had been without a dog for 1 year because Jonathan the Fifth had turned out to be, in the words of the Daily Campus, a crowd-shy maniac.
A maniac.
A maniac.
That sounds a little rash.
For that period, there was, instead of a dog, a quote-unquote two-legged husky, that's a human being in a costume, called Homer the Husky, after Homer Babbage, who was president at the time. But with the arrival of Jonathan the Sixth from the University of Alaska, all that came to an end. The Homer costume was going to be hung up, and the men of Trumbull House were going to be the caregivers for Jonathan as he inspired Husky fans young and old. Tragically, 2 months after his arrival on campus, he was hit by a car while chasing a cat.
Oh, jeez.
This is actually something of an occupational hazard for Jonathan's. Jonathan the First was also hit by a car, as was the Jonathan who was serving in the early 1990s. So 1 year later, now it's April 1965, and now there's another Jonathan, Jonathan the Seventh, also a gift from the University of Alaska, who, you know, could be forgiven for wondering what was going on with all these dogs they were sending to Connecticut. Jonathan VII has a much longer tenure. He serves faithfully until his retirement in 1977 at the homecoming game.
Did we give him a watch?
We might have given him a watch.
Or at least a bone.
Or a bone. According to the official chronology, then Jonathan VIII succeeds him from 1977 to 1991. And then Jonathan VIII is replaced by, of course, Jonathan X.
Huh?
What? You're wondering what happened to Jonathan IX. Well, Alpha Phi Omega, which is the fraternity that takes care of Jonathan, and it's been doing so since the 1970s, they said at the time that Jonathan IX was actually the 10th dog to serve as UConn's mascot. We've accepted the chronology. The university has accepted that chronology, but it disputes it. In multiple articles in the UConn Advance, which was the predecessor to UConn Today, it was put forth that this was a mistake, that the counting was a mistake, and really there were only 13 dogs. So I'll quote from the November 5th, 2001 issue. There appears to have been a mistaken effort in the early 1990s to account for an uncounted mascot, so Jonathan IX became Jonathan X. Research has not turned up reference to a missing dog, although the mix-up appears to stem from Jonathan VI, who died less than 2 months after his arrival on campus. Or does it? So while I was going through the Daily Campus from 1970, I found in the December 1st edition on page 5 this brief unbyline story. Jonathan VIII, one of Connecticut's two purebred husky mascots, was found dead in the Ruby Road area of Mansfield at 8:30 a.m. Monday morning. The silver gray husky, which would have been 3 years old in February, was struck by a car after it ran away from its keeper in Mansfield. The American Kennel Club registered husky was originally purchased from the Norvik Kennels in Cold Harbor, New Hampshire. Since then, the dog had acted as a UConn mascot along with Jonathan VII. The story goes on to note that Jonathan VII was going to continue his role as serving as a mascot, which also cast doubt on the story that he was almost sold that year. Also, I should note that the unnamed reporter made a mistake that the Granite State town in question is Center Harbor, not Cold Harbor. But if you're confused...
I am. I'm very confused.
And Cold Spring Harbor is on Long Island.
That's right. They must have confused the two.
That's really relevant to this story again.
I'm just trying to help.
To sum up, Alpha Phi Omega has maintained since the 1990s that there was an extra uncounted dog.
Can we tell them that they were right?
Alpha Phi Omega was right.
Go Alpha Phi Omega.
The university chronologies are mistaken, and Jonathan VIII, a forgotten good boy, is forgotten no longer.
Aww.
So there have been big revelations this week, shocking revelations even. And if you want more of this kind of thing, we urge you to download, subscribe, rate, review, and tell a friend about our podcast. We will be on Spotify shortly, but in the interim, there's plenty of podcasting venues to choose from to listen to us.
We're still getting mail, I think.
We are still getting mail. And I want to point out that we now have a listener in Oceania.
So we did it.
There's a whale out there.
There's a whale out there. So we're only missing South America. If you are in Brazil or Argentina or Venezuela, please download. You would have had to have already done that. That's true. That's a good point. You can also follow us on Twitter at UConn Podcast, and we love to banter with people in that venue. Speaking of Twitter banter, Julie, how can folks find you and what's new in your world?
I am on Twitter at Julie Bartuka. I just want to encourage people to not only banter with us for fun, we like GIFs a lot on Twitter, but also give us some story ideas. We have a lot of story ideas already, but we're always looking for more. There's a lot we don't know about, so feel free to add us on Twitter, UConn Podcast.
Ken, what about you?
I've been piling up stories for the podcast. I did one this afternoon. I'll do more next week, and...
These are titillating teasers.
But
here,
most importantly, at some point, we will hear the results of the concert choir's trip to Europe.
Yes.
We have audio from...
We're excited about that.
That's
very famous places in Italy and Austria.
And as for me, if you want to cuss me direct, I am at TJ Breen.
He's back on Twitter, guys!
So until a fortnight passes, on behalf of all Jonathans everywhere, this is UConn 360, wishing you well.